Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit Spring House in Tallahassee, the only private residence designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, built in Florida.
What Mr. Wright intended always for anybody who lived in his work to experience, and that is bringing the outside in.
We'll discuss the Miami branch of the NAACP.
Miami's racial justice activism had its origins in the late Depression and World War II eras.
And we'll talk about the mythology surrounding Ponce de Leon and his supposed search for the Fountain of Youth. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Between 1938 and 1958, Frank Lloyd Wright designed a dozen buildings that were constructed on the campus of Florida Southern College in Lakeland, the largest collection of the architect's work in one place. Wright designed several private residences to be constructed in Florida, but only one of them was actually built, Spring House in Tallahassee. The home was designed for George and Clifton Lewis. Clifton Bird Lewis Mashburn, their daughter and current resident of Spring House, explains that her family gained prominence in the state in the mid-19th century.
Well, my great-granddaddy, B.C. Lewis, came from Lynn, Massachusetts. I don't know when he came, but he started the bank out of his own pocket as one person in 1856. And at some point, he got into a building, and so for the Lewis State Bank for more than 100 years was the oldest bank in Florida, and that's how they were known, the Lewis State Bank, the oldest bank in Florida.
George and Clifton Lewis were fans of Frank Lloyd Wright's designs, particularly the house Taliesin West in Scottsdale, Arizona. A chance meeting at Florida Southern College in 1950 led to Spring House being built.
They were down there for an annual meeting of a peace group formed after World War II. It was called the United World Federalists. At their annual meeting, they always went somewhere interesting. In 1950, they went to Florida Southern College. By then, the first thing that they read together was an article about the Jacobs II, if you're familiar with that house. It was the first of what Mr. Wright called his hemicycles. And they fell in love with that house. And so after they read that article, they read Mr. Wright's autobiography.
When the Lewises learned that Frank Lloyd Wright would be at Florida Southern College at the same time that they were, the couple decided to approach the renowned architect, Bird Mashburn.
And when they were at Florida Southern, they did not know Mr. Wright would be there. But they were at their meeting, and he was there for the opening of the new administration building. That would have been a big deal. Everybody who had given money, the students who had built the buildings that were there, and Niels taught those students how to do that. My mother found out, and she said she picked up a newspaper that she didn't usually read when they were down there and saw that Frank Lloyd Wright was going to be there the same time they were. And she was so excited, she said, George, do you think we could try to go meet Frank Lloyd Wright after our meeting is over? And he said, we didn't know they were going to be having a big celebration, but I don't think anybody would mind if we got at the end of the reception line. So that's what they did. And my two older brothers were with them. George Eber was 9, Van was 7. I was five. I didn't get to go. I was apparently out of hand already. And my youngest brother, Ben, was two, our youngest brother. So we were up here somewhere. So they walked up. I wish I'd thought how many people were in the line, how long did it take you, but I didn't think of any of those things. But I think that my dad, because they were actually getting to meet Frank Lloyd Wright, decided on the way up to him that, hey, why don't we ask him? We love his work. And so he said, Cliff, that's what he called my mother, you can ask Mr. Wright if he would design a house for us. And so when she got up to Frank Lloyd Wright, she was, would have been the first one up there, she said, Mr. Wright, we're the Lewises from Tallahassee, and we have a lot of children and not much money. We hope you'll design a house for us. And he said, I know, the more children, the less money, and vice versa. Find your ground, not on a lot, and get in touch.
It took George and Clifton Lewis a little more than a year to find the first 5 acres to build their new home on in Tallahassee. Today, there are 10 acres of property associated with Spring House.
And the reason they bought it is it has some beautiful live oak trees on it, but there was a freshwater spring. It wasn't the kind you could swim in, but it bubbled up. You could see it down there at the spring head that had an 8-foot clay natural wall, and down at the bottom of it was the spring, freshwater spring. There were crawfish and turtles and, you know, everything that would be, and it ran to Lake Jackson. It put fresh water, huge Lake Jackson down there, a quarter of a mile from here. That's why they bought this. That is why my dad named the house Spring House. And that is what Mr. Wright sited the house from. So it's very important to this property and this story. What Mr. Wright intended always for anybody who lived in his work to experience, and that is bringing the outside in.
The main living space in Spring House has built-in seating extending most of the way around a curved living room facing a wall of windows. The Lewises wanted plenty of room for their community activism. Daughter Bird Mashburn.
They contributed a lot in early civil rights. This is really important. They were two of very few of the white community who supported the black community who were protesting for the rights that they should have. And that was not popular then, and it isn't now. Some of the very first integrated meetings in Tallahassee try to help integration be as peaceful as it could were out here. This house was pretty new. Only friends and family knew where it was. It was a safe place for people to meet and talk. And I remember hearing that. I would have been upstairs. That's why my parents asked for this big stretch of seating. They said, we're going to have a lot of meetings and some parties, but we need a lot of seating.
The Lewises and Frank Lloyd Wright shared a love of cypress, and the wood is a primary element in Spring House. The home is obviously curved both inside and out, resembling a boat.
They talked a lot about the Clifton, our sailboat, because 6 people... That's a 21-foot sailboat. It's 8 feet wide. It weighed 2 tons. My daddy designed that so we could basically go safely anywhere we wanted to. I believe that the inspiration for this house came from all my parents told Frank Lloyd Wright about the Clifton and how much time we spent together on it. And I said inspiration for this house, right? And I asked William Allen Storer, who is a recognized Frank Lloyd Wright expert on Mr. Wright's work, what he thought of my idea that that's where this came from. And he said, absolutely. That is exactly the kind of thing that Frank Lloyd Wright was hoping to learn from your family that he could somehow incorporate into the design of your home. And look what he gave us.
The Spring House Institute was formed in 1996 to acquire, preserve, and initiate public programs in the home. We spoke with Clifton Bird Lewis Mashburn, resident of Springhouse in Tallahassee, the only Frank Lloyd Wright designed private residence built in Florida.
I'll light the fire while you place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers. Find great books on Florida history and culture and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
We shall overcome one day. We shall one day, we shall overcome the Lord one day. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Ridges Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Miami's reputation as an international city and a destination best described as a tropical paradise would seem to preclude a study on the role of the NAACP in Miami in the civil rights era.
Chanel Rose was a PhD candidate at the University of Miami in 2007 when she published an article in the Florida Historical Quarterly that challenged traditional thinking on the role of both Miami and the NAACP during the civil rights movement. Quoting from an observation by Miami Herald reporter Philip Mayer, that the city is, quote, neither northern nor typically southern, but a kind of sociological capsule suspended between two worlds. She noted that such characterization also limited the scope of scholarly investigations of the black freedom struggle in South Florida. Rose argues that, quote, a close inspection of civil rights activism in Miami in the 1950s reveals the critical role of the local NAACP in the forced desegregation of the city's schools, buses, golf clubs, parks, swimming pools, and beaches, end quote. Her analysis not only challenges the view of Miami as a progressive city, which, like Atlanta, displayed little evidence of racial confrontation, but also challenges the Montgomery to Selma classical narrative of the civil rights movement and the view that the NAACP was conservative and uninvolved with the movement after the Brown decision. An analysis of the role of the NAACP, she claims, emphasizes the post-war emergence of an aggressive black middle-class cohort of ministerial, professional, and business leaders that was essential to the fight for racial equality.
So Rose is telling us that Miami civil rights activism predated the traditional narrative that begins with the Montgomery bus boycott and that the NAACP played a larger role than previously acknowledged.
Yes, Miami's racial justice activism had its origins in the late Depression and World War II eras and was linked to population changes and the emergence of a black leader of Afro-Christian liberalism, Father John F. Culmer. Between 1940 and 1950, as Miami experienced a population surge of more than 120,000 new residents, a growth that would continue until the city boasted a 500,000 residents by the mid-1950s, the percentage of black residents decreased simultaneously, reducing the political pressure blacks could exert. And although Miami fostered its image as a tropical paradise, black Miamians sat in the back of the bus, used segregated water fountains, attended underfunded schools, and lived in deplorable housing, a constant reminder of their second-class status. As Edith Perry, Miami's white NAACP secretary, observed, quote, Miami had an appearance of more liberality and freedom than actually existed, end quote. Although Father Culmer, a Bahamian-born Episcopal priest, had overseen notable advances by embracing New Deal liberalism, by the late 1940s, many of Miami's black leaders labeled his accommodationist style and his progressive achievements as symbols of racial tokenism. The most prominent black activist to emerge in place of Father Comer was another Episcopal priest, Father Theodore R. Gibson, rector of Christ Episcopal Church. Father Gibson had learned two important lessons that would advance social justice for Miami's black community. First, quote, white men would listen to a Negro minister when they wouldn't listen to any other Negro, end quote. And two, working together with already established black organizations provided the most efficient mechanism for achieving the goals identified by the community. Gibson's first collaboration came in 1948, when he joined forces with white housing reformer Elizabeth Virick to found the Coconut Grove Citizens Committee for Slum Clearance, and made significant gains in sanitation and health reform measures that included sewage disposal, running water, and garbage collection. In a collaborative effort with Edward T. Graham, the new pastor of Mount Zion Baptist Church, Gibson petitioned the Dade County School Board for improvements in the city's deteriorating black schools. Working with the Negro Service Council, Gibson fought against job discrimination, juvenile delinquency, and racial injustice. In 1959, the NSC successfully integrated Jackson Memorial Hospital. The NSC, quote, received strong support from the Anti-Defamation League, the National Council of Christians and Jews, and the Dade County Council on Community Relations. They encouraged black voter registration and black political candidates. Rose characterized the 1930s Miami branch of the NAACP as marked by, quote, internal strife, small membership, and poor leadership, end quote. But in the early post-war years, the branch found new life, especially with the bombing of the home of Harry T. Moore in 1951, the Groveland Four, and the 1954 Brown decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Father Gibson also became president of the Miami branch of the NAACP in 1954 and, quote, carried it to a new level of activism, end quote. He became the symbol of the militant integrationist movement and viewed direct confrontation with Miami's white establishment as the most effective way to gain results, end quote. Gibson linked the NAACP to existing community organizations, including the Miami Times newspaper, which, according to Rose, quote, became a semi-official organ of the NAACP, keeping the organization before the community. Gibson encouraged pastors to set aside NAACP Sunday to solicit membership and inform their congregations about the organization's activities. Churchwomen and business and professional leaders also pushed membership drives, and the organization exceeded its goals of 5,000 new members in 1956.
Connie, the work of Father Gibson and the NAACP must have attracted state notice.
Yes, two important events demonstrate both the conservatism of the Miami NAACP and its defiance of state pressure. In June 1956, Gibson threatened the Miami public transportation system with a bus boycott following the arrest of Reverend C.K. Steele in the Tallahassee bus boycott. Unlike events in the state capital, there was no racial incident in Miami to spark a boycott. Moreover, black leaders counseled against such a move that they viewed as unlikely to be successful. In October 1956, local NAACP attorney G.E. Graves filed a class action lawsuit against the Miami Transit Company. 3 months later, federal judge Emmett C. Choate ruled that Miami and Florida's bus segregation laws were unconstitutional in light of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in Montgomery. Having taken a more conservative route to desegregation of Miami's transportation system ignores the counterattack by white supremacist groups, most particularly the investigation of the Miami NAACP by the Florida Legislative Investigations Committee, better known as the Johns Committee. Using the tactics of the McCarthy Committee, the Johns Committee targeted Miami for a special investigation to demonstrate infiltration of the local NAACP by communists. Charlie Johns promised to, quote, name names, places, and dates of a communist conspiracy to start a racial revolution in the South, end quote. Black Miamians viewed the investigation as retaliation for the intensified campaign to integrate Miami and Dade County's public facilities. Father Gibson and Pastor Graham were held in contempt when they refused to cooperate with the committee and turn over branch membership lists. Rose concludes that the Miami fight against the Johns Committee demonstrated how Miami's peculiar racial climate influenced less explosive movement while reinforcing the role of the NAACP in early black protests before the classical period of the civil rights movement.
An interesting look at Florida's early civil rights efforts. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
We shall be free, Lord, one day.
This is Florida Frontiers. One of Florida's most enduring myths is about Ponce de Leon's supposed search for the Fountain of Youth. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Rick Kilby is the author of the award-winning Finding the Fountain of Youth, Ponce de Leon and Florida's Magical Waters, and Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts, and Health Spas, both released by the University Press of Florida in 2013 and 2020, respectively. I spoke with Rick primarily about his first book, Finding the Fountain of Youth. According to legend, Spanish conquistador Juan Ponce de Leon explored Florida in an attempt to find the coveted Fountain of Youth, mystical waters that can seemingly restore one's age and health to a vigorous state. Many scholars, including Rick, have long debunked this myth, as historical evidence suggests that Ponce de Leon's political rivals actually manufactured the myth to discredit and tarnish his image. Rick's book, more importantly, however, examines how and why the Ponce de Leon myth has endured so successfully throughout Florida's history that the fable remains inextricably tied to the state's image. Florida's natural freshwater springs prove central to the myth's longevity.
Around 1850, before the Civil War, Florida is very much an economy based on agriculture, and there are as many enslaved individuals, perhaps more, than there are non-enslaved individuals, and we're slow to develop. And so after the Civil War, things kind of take off. And so you see this influx of people trying to encourage tourism and immigration into the state because the economy of Florida was decimated during the Civil War. So they just wanted people to come here and spend money. And so this is how the springs come in. You know, one of the ways they attracted people was the climate, and this abundance of freshwater springs was supposedly healthful. And there was this whole resort culture that existed in Europe and in parts of the Northeast United States, where people wanted to go to these spas, and their consumption was a big disease during that time. And it was believed being outdoors and bathing in warm water during the winter was helpful for consumption. So they saw this as an idea to bring people in Florida, and a lot of these springs were developed into spas along the St. John's River and the Suwannee River, where people could come down and reinvent themselves and restore their health. So that's connected to the Fountain of Youth, that whole idea of restoration and recreation and rejuvenation.
Indeed, many developers marketed their spas with those romantic themes of rejuvenation and restoration derived from the Fountain of Youth myth, which resulted in several Fountain of Youths appearing throughout Florida in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Every spring that is marketed commercially at some point or another claims to be the Fountain of Youth. And that's one of the things that encouraged me in writing the book, because there's a spring in Pinellas County, Wall Springs, claimed to be the Fountain of Youth. There's Warm Mineral Springs, which is today located in Northport, actually is older than the town of Northport, that claimed to be the Fountain of Youth. I've seen articles and references to Silver Springs as the Fountain of Youth. In fact, the state has two Ponce de Leon Springs, one in Holmes County and one in Volusia County here in Central Florida, with the name Ponce de Leon that claimed to be the Fountain of Youth. And I think I've seen Salt Springs in the Ocala National Forest called the Fountain of Youth. Every spring claims that because, one, again, it's low-hanging fruit, it's easy marketing. But two, when you jump in 72-degree water and it's 25, 30 degrees warmer than that, you feel rejuvenated. You feel young again. There's no way you can't feel alive when you first jump into the spring. Some of the places that were marketed as fountains of youth were actually wells that were dug, and they had scents of sulfur or high mineral content, and they would bottle the water and people would come to drink and they thought that the water was good for them, but they were never actually springs.
Rick used newspapers, advertisements, postcards, photos, and other sources to unveil how, throughout Florida's history, many invoked and embraced the Fountain of Youth mythos.
Old advertising and ephemera, and you can find testimonials that are connected to the Fountain of Youth. There's one ad that I often show in my programs that it's Thomas Edison. You know, he had a winter home in Fort Myers, and he said his life was extended by 5 years by being in Florida. And people like Flagler, you know, he had this resort system on the East Coast. He talked about the Fountain of Youth and his promotional materials. And one of my favorites is John Harvey Kellogg, who decided he would start a spa in Florida. During that time, he put out a brochure for the Department of Citrus talking about how Florida citrus could extend your life, that being in Florida and eating citrus would make you live longer. And when he finally had his spa built in Miami Springs, he thought that just the climate here would make you live longer. When some of these people came down and started to develop Florida after the end of the 19th century, a lot of it was marketing, and a lot of it was, you know, it's low-hanging fruit. It's an obvious solution. People know the Fountain of Youth, so it's easy in terms of advertising. So people kind of glommed onto that idea.
Through Rick's research, we understand how several historical actors deliberately appropriated and indeed maximized Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth mythology, which became so central in undergirding the broader idea that the state's identity and image remained tied to one of paradise and rebirth. However, maintaining such an idea requires degrading the environment, and recognizing the dangerous environmental implications of this self-constructed image also proves vital to Rick's work.
1,000 people a day move to Florida, or some crazy number like that. And it's become part of our DNA, and it's become part of our own state's mythology, that people believe that as soon as you drive over the state line, it's you get a tabula rasa and you get to start over. And they perpetuate that today. I can see connections to the way the current governor is promoting Florida, you know, this place where you're free, you know, the rules are different here, all those kind of notions. And you can see popular places that are still growing in today's economy, places like the Villages, you know, they really attach themselves as this place where senior citizens can come and have a whole new life, and they can have the lifestyle of their dreams. And retirement communities throughout the state have really kind of glommed onto that idea. I think we have to understand that. I think it gives us an opportunity to grow smarter and not just try and develop every corner and put retirement communities everywhere. We need to realize that there are younger families here and communities, and there's important quality of life issues that have to be addressed other than just building golf courses.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can also listen as a podcast and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.